Thanks for the nice introduction. So even after this many years, I'm still very much fascinated by this connection between lattice and the Lorentz theory, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So the title is Lifshitz Lattice, Tuft, and Luttinger. So this is basically the title of the first paper that's cited here. I guess the only reason I for this title is to confuse people. But anyway, the common theme here is that is anomaly. Okay. All right. And I'll also talk about some unpublished work that hopefully we will get it out. All right. So I'm pretty sure that everyone in this room agrees that at least one of the important questions in condensed matter physics or quantum many-body system is to understand emergence in many-body systems. That we often start with some sort of lattice model with local interactions. Hamiltonian has local interactions, and under some sort of RG flow, right, we approach a low-energy limit, and very often the Lorentz limit or the thermodynamic limit or continuum limit can be described by a nice quantum field theory, okay, that captures everything that happens at low energy and long wavelengths. Okay, so this is a schematic RG flow. Of course, it's in practice, it's extremely difficult to understand this RG flow. So that's why it's very, very valuable to have some sort of invariants that go along this RG flow and just don't change. So we can have some connection between the UV and IR. And as far as I know, the most general invariants that we can think about are global symmetries and Tuft anomalies. Okay, so the first part of the talk is sort of just, I want to give some motivation of the problems that I'll discuss. So let's just review what is a Tuft anomaly. So let's say we have our system, in this context, is the lattice model, even though everything applies to continuum theory as well. So we have some lattice system with a global symmetry. This includes internal symmetry and lattice symmetries. And for internal symmetries, we know how the story goes, right? So with the internal global symmetry, the system can be coupled to a background gauge field or defects. Okay. And anomaly refers to non-trivial phases, the buried kind of buried phase in quotes, in the space of states of defects with defects or background gauge fields. Okay. And the good thing about anomaly is that they're independent of energy scale. So you can use it to do anomaly matching from UV to IR. And they cannot be reproduced by any symmetry-preserving short-range entangled state. So we have some kind of no-go theorem, or the most general version of Lifshitz Lattice type theorem is that a system with Tuft anomaly cannot have a trivial low-energy theory, or cannot have a symmetry-preserving short-range entangled state. Maybe I want to use this. And on the other side, there's an even kind of stronger version of the statement that the Lorentz theory must reproduce the anomalous response. Okay. So the feature must be reproduced from the Lorentz theory. Okay, and to probe the anomalies, we make use of symmetry defects, which is a localized change in the Hamiltonian. But this change is topological in the sense that you can move this defect around by a unitary operator. So it does not affect local physics, since we can move it outside the region that you're interested in. And we can construct topological defects out of any global symmetry, basically by truncating this symmetry to a finite region. And since it's a symmetry of a Hamiltonian, it does not do anything inside that region. The only change that happens is at the boundary of this region. And that is one defect. Of course, if you apply a symmetry to a finite interval in this 1D system, you would get two defects. But since they are localized changes of Hamiltonian, you can just take one of them and call it a defect. All right. And in some part of the talk, I'll discuss anomaly using a particular Hamiltonian, but the results do not really depend on details. It's just convenient to have some Hamiltonian. Okay, and they're basically a particular representation of flat background gauge fields. Okay, so there's a general question of how to compute anomaly given a quantum system, quantum many-body system with symmetry. And for internal symmetries, I believe there's a fairly systematic way to extract the anomaly, at least for bosonic system in 1 plus 1D. Okay? And similar ideas probably work in higher dimensions as presented in these papers. However, it's less clear how to apply these procedures to lattice symmetries or spatial symmetries. All right, so that is about anomaly. And the other question that will be sort of the focus of the talk is the continuum limit. Okay. So let's use this setup. So it's convenient to consider a finite volume system, even though eventually we are interested in the thermodynamic limit, but it's good to start from a finite volume system and eventually take the number of sites to infinity. All right, and then we have to think about how the continuum limit is approached. Okay. So sometimes the limit is very smooth as a function of system size L. And here's an example that probably everyone knows, and we all learned it in, I guess, in grad school, that if you take a ferromagnetic icing model, and so this is a lattice model, and you take the continuum limit, we know the limit is just a real scalar Phi-4 theory. And we know how to go from a lattice model to a continuum by doing cold screening, and there's no surprise in taking the continuum limit here. However, there are examples where the limit is not smooth, meaning that taking different sequences of system size will give you different results. Okay? And many examples in spin 1/2 systems, especially when you have anti-ferromagnetic couplings, have this feature, that the continuum limit is not smooth in system size. So oftentimes, there is a well-defined QFT, quantum field theory, that captures all the local physics. So if you ask a question about correlation functions of local observables, it doesn't really depend on the system size because you can do everything locally. It doesn't really care about the size of a system. Okay? However, even in that case, the limit does not have to be smooth. So one possibility to resolve this kind of the difference between a local local physics and the global physics is that the different limits correspond to this field theory. There's a well-defined field theory with different topological defects inserted. As we just discussed, they don't affect local physics, so you're not going to see these defects locally, but they can affect the global global aspects of the problem. And as we'll see, non-smooth limits often related to an anomaly of eminent symmetry, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. Okay. So let's look at a concrete example of a spin 1/2 chain. So of course, this model has a long history, but somehow, surprisingly, I'm still learning new things from this model, even though it feels like we know everything about it. Okay, so this is just a standard spin 1/2 chain with Heisenberg, anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg coupling. You can add more terms, but the first term already suffices to illustrate these points. And quite obviously, we know the even and odd number of sites are different because if you have even number of sites, you can have a spin singly ground state. If you have odd number of sites, then there must be some degeneracy in the spectrum. So let's say we just limit ourselves to even number of sites. But it turns out that there are still two limits if you consider translation symmetry. So let's put the system on a ring with periodic boundary condition. So there's a translation symmetry. Then we can label lattice translation symmetry. Then we can label eigenstates by lattice momentum. Okay? So I'll write it as e to the ik. So this is the lattice momentum living in the Brillouin zone. Now, this is something you can work out using just exact dialization of the model or looking at the beta ansatz. So when L is a multiple of 4, you have 4k number of sites, where k is an integer, then the ground state lies at zero momentum, the zero lattice momentum. When L is 4k plus 2, the ground state is at pi. Okay. So it kind of oscillates between 0 and pi every time you add 2 sites. And for all number of sites, there's the ground state is more or less at pi over 2, plus minus pi over 2, plus some 1 over L correction. Okay. So how do we understand this pattern? No. Where does this come from? That's one question. Yes?
Is it plus or minus pi over 2? Does it just depend on the 4k plus 1 or 4k plus 2?
That, yeah, so this with this part depend on whether it's L mod 4k plus 1 or 4k plus 3.
Why? Because,
so there are two, so the point is that there are two almost degenerate ground state, one at pi over 2, the other at minus pi over 2, and the difference is just 1 over L. That's on top of the spin 1/2 degeneracy. So in the large L limit, there are actually 4 ground states. Yeah, but you cannot hit pi over 2 exactly for odd L, so there must be some 1 over L correction. And we can actually figure out that correction.
So that degeneracy is due to time reversal?
That degeneracy, you can say it's due to time reversal or parity. Right. OK, to understand this, we need to think about the lattice symmetry and how it enters a low energy theory a little more carefully. So here I want to discuss a little bit the distinction between emergent and eminent symmetries. So this word eminent, I can't really give you a good explanation of why we choose this name. I think it has origin in something that emanates from the lattice symmetry. Okay. Anyway, so that's somehow we chose to use this name. So we know very well that if you take the Heisenberg chain, the low energy theory is the SU2 level 1 CFT, the conformal field theory, the Wesselman-Witten model. And we can figure out all the symmetries in this problem. So the UV symmetry, I'm just going to consider SO3 and translation, no parity or time reversal. And the symmetry of the low energy theory is, not surprisingly, much larger. It's SO4 with two SU2 subgroups. Rotating left moving and right moving fields, and you quotient out the Z2. Okay, so of course, this is much larger than the UV symmetry, so a large part of it is our emergent symmetries, which are broken by irrelevant operators in the low energy theory. For example, the SU2 left rotation is actually broken by irrelevant operators. Except the diagonal SO3, you rotate both in left and right at the same time, that is the exact SO3 in the lattice model. Okay. Now, there's another symmetry, which is not explicitly there in the lattice model, but it emerges from the, or emanates from the lattice translation symmetry. So it is an exact symmetry in the IR theory, in the sense that there are no irrelevant operators to break this symmetry. Okay. So this is the central element of SO4. And because the C actually comes from the lattice translation. So it becomes an exact symmetry in the IR theory, even though it's not explicitly a symmetry in the UV. You have to combine it with the lattice translation. All right, so C is an example of eminent symmetry. You may say it's just part of emergent symmetry, but it feels like we have to give it a distinguished role in this discussion, because it's really exact.
Is SO3 also an example of eminent symmetry?
It's just the exact symmetry because it's the same symmetry in UV and IR. Right? In UV, it's also internal symmetry. In IR, it's internal symmetry. Here, the difference, here, the name just emphasizes the fact that in IR, this C is an internal symmetry, but in UV, you really have to look at the translation symmetry. Right? So that's the reason to kind of distinguish it from the other emergent symmetries. Okay, this is just the finite size spectrum of Heisenberg chain to convince you that we do have this 0 to pi oscillation. All right. Now, there's another example where you have very strong kind of interplay between lattice and continuum. Well, not continuum, but no. The lattice effects are actually seen at low energy, and that is an example of fracton systems. So I guess many of you have seen these models. I'm not going to discuss in detail any of them. But two things that are common to all of these fracton-like models is that, at least in these gapped fracton models, you have a topological ground state degeneracy, as topological as any other models that you like, toric code or quantum Hall. However, the number of states grow typically exponentially with L, but with some fluctuations. And fluctuations could be very wild. Like you change L by 1, the state goes from some 4 to L to just 2. Okay? And together with this extensive degeneracy, sub-extensive degeneracy, translation acts very non-trivially on topological observables. Okay? So they kind of come together. And that manifests as constraints on the mobility of excitations. So this is another example where the lattice effects are very important even at low energy, even when you just look at ground state observables, topological observables. OK, so the talk will be divided into two parts. The first part, I'll explore a little more these eminent symmetries and their consequence in the Heisenberg chain. I forgot to say, no, please feel free to interrupt. And any questions so far beyond?
So for the fractons, can it be interpreted as, for different sizes, can it be interpreted as some defects?
Yeah, that's a good question. Although it's very tempting to say that. But I think so far, we don't really have a solid picture. For this kind of theory, we know that different sizes can be interpreted as having different defects. But for fractons, it almost feels like you have to say the different sizes corresponding to inserting different non-invertible defects. But that picture hasn't been made precise yet, as far as I know. It feels like that's somehow part of the story, right? But we don't know how actually it works. All right. So again, this is a puzzle. I think this is a little puzzle that I want to resolve. And more generally, I want to explain the universal aspects of the finite size spectrum, just using the continuum theory, how much we can explain these universal aspects. Of course, there are non-universal aspects. Velocity and different L may have a different additive constants and all that. But can we explain, for example, all the quantum numbers? The universal, like at the CFT, there's low energy spectrum up to rescaling are universal. So can we explain all that using just the continuum theory? Okay, so to do that, I need to consider a bit more carefully the defects in the spin chains. Okay, and since we are really doing things on a lattice, we're not going to consider the theory on some weird space-time manifold. The only one that we really have is a torus. So this is a circle where the spin chain lives. And then there's a time direction. So suppose we are looking at a partition function. So this is the imaginary time, periodic direction. Okay, and I'll denote a group of internal symmetry as G of internal. Okay, so what kind of defects can we have? Can we put in this setup? Well, you can have an internal symmetry defect along the spatial direction. So that's represented by this straight line. They just goes straight in time direction. There's a defect here. And we can choose any element of the internal symmetry and put a defect. Or we can have a defect line in a time direction, which just means when you do the trace, calculate a trace of the thermal density matrix, you put a symmetry operator in the trace. Right? So that comes out as a defect line in the time direction. However, on torus, these two have to commute. Otherwise, you cannot really close up the trace. So once we fix a G of the spatial defect, then the H has to commute with G. So it has to live in the centralizer of G, the center of G in the symmetry group. But H can be an internal symmetry or a translation symmetry or an aspatial symmetry. Okay, so basically, just what I just said. G is internal, but H may be internal or lattice symmetry. And we can consider this partition function with the H inserted. And sometimes we refer to it as a defect partition function. OK, so we can do this for SO3 chain if that somewhat feels a little abstract. For example, for SO3 chain, we can For SO3 system, we can have an internal symmetry labeled by, well, a defect, internal symmetry defect labeled by any element of SO3. And once you fix that, we can ask what are the remaining symmetries depending on the symmetry element you choose. And we can explicitly write down the Hamiltonian with a defect, just some phase vector. And once you put in this defect, the original translation operator does not commute with H of sigma. So you have to modify it by attaching a local operator, a local unitary, kind of to move the defect back. All right. So as an exercise, let's see how the Lipschitz-Mattis anomaly, the Lipschitz-Mattis theorem, manifests in this kind of formulation.
So you want to restrict yourself to not consider defects of translation in space?
Well, I'll consider that. But this is something we can explicitly do in Lattice model. For the translation defect, as you know, we have to kind of make that, we have to assert at some point that it's different sizes are different translation defects. But I definitely come to that. Right. All right. So we can look at this defect partition function, but now you have a few different parameters. You can put in a SO3 defect in space and then SO3 defect in time and also translation. Okay. And we can derive how the partition. So there are three parameters. Well, there are two parameters, sigma and c. They're both U1 parameters. And then there's number of translations you do. And we can study how the partition function, how partition function depends on these parameters. Okay. So the details are not important. There are some phase vectors. And if you look at carefully at these relations, one can show that all of these relations define a non-trivial line bundle in some sense. On the space of this, on the parameter space, sigma c and n. I mean, n is discrete, but on the space of sigma c. Okay. So you cannot have a trivial theory, meaning that they have a single ground state at low energy. Then the partition function is just a number, a non-zero number. Then you would be able to construct a trivial line bundle over this this space of parameters. And that's impossible due to these signs. Okay. So we can shift these signs around by making some redefinition of operators, but you can never get rid of these signs. OK, so that's at least one way to see that there's something going on. And that's a well-known Lipschitz-Mattis anomaly. Now, let's actually go to the low-energy theory. So we've already mentioned that the low-energy theory of a Heisenberg chain is SU2 level 1. Of course, this can be generalized a bit to the XXZ chain. So the Lorentz theory is just a Luttinger liquid, or a free boson in one dimension. Okay. And the global symmetry in this model are the spin rotation symmetry, which was SO3 for Heisenberg chain, but here is O2, but doesn't really matter. Then there's a Lattice translation. For a finite system, it's Z of L. Okay, so in this range of parameters, the model flows to a C equals 1 Luttinger liquid. And we know how various operators in the Lattice model look like in the continuum. For example, the S of Z is just the U1 charge. There are two U1 charges in the continuum theory. So it's just one of U1 charge. And the translation becomes the continuous translation. It's just this guy times this C operator, okay, which was the eminence symmettry. And in this Luttinger liquid representation, the C looks like shifting both phi and theta by pi. Okay. So it seems like we know everything about how the symmetries act on the low energy degree of freedom. And we can calculate the anomaly of these symmetries. Okay. So before we do that, let's discuss a bit how to at least think about the finite spectrum of the chain. Okay. So here is I'm going to make the claim. The claim is that if I have a system of length L, then the continuum theory describing this system is the SU2 level 1 of the Luttinger liquid, but with L number of defects inserted. Okay. It's not just that these are somewhat similar. It's precisely this continuum theory when you look at the low-energy spectrum of a system of length L, up to some non-universal constants in velocity or in additive energy. Okay. All right. So let's see how this proposal works out in this example. Okay. So for L even, this C is a Z2 symmetry. So even number of L means even number of C defects means no defect. At least up to this point, looks like there's no defect. And we will just get a free boson CFT without any defect. And that does agree with the spectrum of the theory. If you have L odd, it means that you have a free boson CFT or SU2 level 1 defect, CFT with a C defect. And that does match the spectrum of the spin chain with odd number of L, the low energy spectrum. OK, and no, we can also work out the Lipschitz-Mathis anomaly. And this, no, many people, this has been done more than once in literature. So I'm not going to repeat this analysis. Now, we still have to explain this mod 4 dependence. Somehow, L and L plus 2, even though they have identical low energy spectrum, okay, up to some rescaling, this interpretation, still, the ground state momentum is different from L to L plus 2. So the continuum limit does not just depend on L mod 2. It actually depends on L mod 4. Okay. And to explain that, we need to actually think about the anomaly of this eminence symmetry, the Z2 group generated by C. Okay. So let me write down the anomaly action. So it's convenient to write down the action in one dimension higher. It's just seems like the best way to represent anomaly is to write the action in 2 plus 1 dimension. Here's a little a is a gauge field of this Z2C. Okay. It has two terms. One of them is responsible for the Lipschitz-Mathis anomaly. And I'm not going to look at this term. And the other term is anomaly of A or Z2C alone, okay. Anomaly of the eminence symmetry. So what does it mean? Well, pictorially, what it means is that if you have some topological defect lines or gauge fields of the C, and C is a Z2 gauge field, so the only thing you can have is these defect lines. Okay. And if you recouple these lines, you get a minus sign. Okay. And this is basically doing a local gauge transformation here to recouple these defect lines. And as a consequence, if we think about the space-time torus, and with the following defect lines. So they have two C defect lines in space, well, two C defects in space, and we put a C defect in the time direction. If you fuse these defects because of Z2, you should be able to fuse them and get rid of the defects. However, that will pop out. There's an additional minus sign that pops out when you fuse these two C defects. Okay. So to see this from the recoupling relation, we can do a simple exercise. So to make sense of the picture, we have to resolve these crossings. You choose one way to resolve it and use it for both of them. And then we can use a recoupling rule to deform this configuration back to just a straight line in the time direction, wrap around in time direction. Okay. And that minus sign is a minus sign here. Okay. So there's some statement about the states with two C defects we can make. The quantum number of C actually changes when you fuse these two C defects. And let's now put this back in the context of lattice model and see what this really means. Okay, so let's reinterpret this statement in the context of lattice model. So having a C symmetry in the time direction just means we're measuring the ground state momentum, since that's where the C comes from in the lattice model. It just means that we are measuring the ground state momentum or measuring the eigenvalue of a translation operator. Okay. According to my proposal earlier, every site of the system really corresponds to a C defect. So two C defect means I have two more sites compared, on this side compared to the picture on the right. Okay. So now the lattice interpretation of the picture means the ground state momentum of a system with, say, L plus two sites is minus of the ground state momentum, or the eigenvalue, of L sites. Okay. And that is the origin of this oscillation of ground state momentum on L mod 4. So basically, the resolution of this little puzzle of how the ground state momentum depends on L, actually, you can trace it all the way back to the anomaly of eminence symmetry in the continuum. And The point is that, no, the continuum theory really knows about this elf mod 4 dependence through the anomaly. It has a universal explanation. And furthermore, we can work out not only the ground state momentum for even L and also for odd L. So this is the 1/L correction that I discussed earlier. And you can also work this out from the low-energy theory, okay? and the knowledge of the symmetry. And finally, these expressions work even for very small L, like L equals 2. And that's an exercise that I can do in real time. So if you have two spins, the Heisenberg model is just S1 dot S2. And we know the ground state is spin singlet. And the translation is swapping the two spins, and the spin singlet is antisymmetric. And that agrees with L1L is 2 mod 4, it's minus 1. Okay. So of course, I'm not claiming that we should expect all of these things to work for small L, but it's just somewhat funny that even for this small L, in this model, it works.
Isn't there some ambiguity in applying the momentum again? What if you just modify the translation operated by some?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have said that. Right, so in order to compare the lattice momentum of different systems with different size, we have to fix some convention for translation. And in this problem, in this spin chain problem, there's a natural convention. Basically, we pick some product state basis, like SZ basis, and demand that translation does not have any phase vector in that basis. Okay. Or you take a state with all spin up, and that translation invariant should have eigenvalue 1. And that fixes the phases for different size. So everything has to, everything I said relies on that assumption, on that kind of fixing of the phase ambiguity. Yes, thanks.
So if I consider adding to the model some next mu symmetrical coupling, will this scale work for L equal to 2 and 3?
If the coupling is small, right, it's not going to cause any level crossing, then the same thing will work, right?
Well, L equal to 2 and
there's no other coupling to add for L equal to 2?
There are no other couplings. First of all, there are no other couplings to add. For L equals 3, you can add couplings. But the thing that if you keep SO3 invariance, adding more coupling means you're just shuffling energy levels around, right? So that's the only thing that changes. So of course, you can imagine once you add large additional couplings, you move the ground state to somewhere else. But it's not guaranteed that it will always work for small L. It just maybe just a coincidence in this case.
Don't you expect that for an integrable model that you're at least at the fixed point?
Probably, but again, I don't want to attach any deep meanings to this statement. It's just a somewhat curious fact.
This model is not a fixed point of bicycle level 1. There's a marginally random operator.
Yeah, there is marginally random operator, right? Yeah, it's not at a fixed point.
So regarding the
hello. Sorry, can I ask a question?
Sure. Yeah.
So can you go back to the XXZ model?
Yes?
Yeah. So the way I understand this spin chain is through the algebraic beta ansatz and quantum groups.
Okay.
And the associated half algebra is UQSU2, right? Or UQSL2?
I think so. I'll trust you.
Yeah. Right. So in any case, given that that's true, there's some literature about that. And given that that's true, then I would expect the continuum limit or the continuum field theory to be described by like a Chern-Simons type theory, like SU2 level, whatever. Something like that. So I noticed that in the continuum field theory, you wrote down something very similar, right?
Uh-huh. SU2 level 1.
But you have this, level 1, yeah. But well, you have this W2 term.
That's anomaly.
Yeah, that's the anomaly. So I was wondering, exactly. So it seems that you have dA equals W2. That seems like the well, what people usually do when they, you know, try to absorb anomalies into a background gauge field or something like that. I'm just wondering, like, if you know any way to kind of see this anomaly in the Hopf algebra. Maybe it's a long shot, but like,
I have to admit that I know not even very little. I know zero about Hopf algebra. All of these statements follow from the Luange theory. No, I think the thing about Hopf algebra, all of these integrable structure, that really only works for nearest neighbor Heisenberg coupling. If you add next nearest neighbor, it breaks the integrability. So I don't expect the Hopf algebra to be relevant once you deform it away from the integrable point. But these conclusions are fairly robust against, you know, adding, for example, integrability breaking couplings, because it's really just a property of a Luange theory. And as long as it's the same Luange theory, it has the same anomaly structure. Does that answer the question?
Right, but I was just wondering, like, I agree with you that if you add, like, next nearest neighbor stuff, then maybe, like, the Bethe ansatz might be a little bit more involved. But, like, in any case, in this theory, right,
yeah,
we do have UQSL2, and I was just wondering if there's a way to see this W2 pop up in UQSL2, and then kind of see how it pops up, or do we just really have to look at the
okay.
Luange theory?
I guess I don't know UQL2 good enough to answer the question. My way of seeing that is through the Luange theory, and I guess there's a way to, if there's a way to identify the Luange theory from the quantum group, then it should follow. But again, yeah, I don't have anything else to say.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. So
regarding the ambiguity of this translation symmetry,
uh-huh,
is it possible to find other basis of product states such that you get rid of this L-dependent moment?
I would think that I haven't thought very carefully about other product state basis. But first off, since it's SU2, so no, if you choose any product state for each site, it should be the same, right? Now, whether there are other bases that is not just a product of states on each site, that is not clear. Okay. And it's hard to define translation if your basis is not, you know, a product of site. The question arises, for example, if you think about the similar problem in the case of a Majorana chain. There's no translation invariant product state basis to begin with. And then it is indeed the first question one has to resolve. What does it even mean, right? But in this case, I think there's no ambiguity. Once you choose some site product state basis, then that should fix ambiguity. All right, so if there's no more questions, I'll go to my next part of the talk, which is somewhat different, even though it's still under this theme of lattice anomaly. Okay. Now, there's a different kind of anomaly on the lattice. There's always a debate of whether we should call this Tuft anomaly or not. I'm not going to say anything about that question, but let's just say we have this filling condition on lattice, the Lipschitz lattice for filling, okay, for U1. So the setup is the following. So we have a translation invariant lattice model with U1 symmetry. And the total charge of the U1 symmetry is the sum over local charge density on each site, where this n, little n, is an integer. And we take a thermodynamic limit with a fixed filling factor. So the total number of charges divided by the total number of sites is fixed to be some ratio. And I'm just going to think about the case where this ratio is a fractional number, or is a rational number.
There's a lot of interesting stuff when it happens specifically when U is irrational, right?
Yeah, I know. But no, here is only about the rational case. Yes. When it's irrational, it's actually leads to powerful constraints. But here I'm going to just discuss the rational case. Yes. Right. And this is a statement, Lipschitz-Mattis and the higher dimensional generalization by Oshikawa Hastings, is that when this nu is not integer, you cannot have a symmetric short-range entangled state. So, no, it's the same statement we expect from a Tuft anomaly. Okay. All right, and then you can ask, okay, so symmetric short-range entangled states are not allowed. What kind of states are actually possible. And I'm going to assume that the states are gapped. So this is all about gap states in this kind of system. And we know when it's gapped, well, generically it has to be long-range entangled. But when it's gapped, you can say more. OK, so I want to derive some constraints. Now it's not just about ruling out short-range entangled states, symmetric short-range entangled state. I want to actually be able to say something more specific about what the long-range entangled state should look like.
No. Sorry, so you're not in one dimension anymore?
I'm going to do it in one dimension first. But there's a cast state as a long-range entangled state. But yeah, in that one dimension, we know, or even in higher dimension, we know what's going to happen. But I'm going to review this argument, which is essentially equivalent to the usual Oshikawa-type proof of flux insertion, but it's formulated a little more, at least to my taste, a little simpler, so we can apply it very easily to subsystem symmetries. So this is essentially equivalent to Oshikawa's proof, okay, but a slight different formulation. OK, so let's take a 1D system with this Fresnel filling. And I'm going to consider the restriction of the charge, total charge operator to an interval from A to B. So AB is the interval of this 1D system. Okay. Restriction just means I sum over all the sites inside the interval for the charge density. Now, suppose you have a gap ground state of some Hamiltonian. Then one can prove that this QAB, this is essentially the argument I just described, we can restrict the symmetry and get two defects. If you apply this Q to a gap ground state, the effect is the same as the difference of two local operators, one localized at B, the other one's at A. So paraphrase it, you can measure the total charge in the gap ground state by just measuring some local operator at the two ends of this interval. You can even construct these operators through the quasi-adiabatic evolution of the current operator. But suffice to know that exist these local operators, local observables. And now we can exponentiate QAB and consider e to the 2 pi QAB. We should really understand it as e to the I theta QAB, but theta goes to 2 pi, the limit. Otherwise, this is identity. And the result of taking that kind of limit is that we have e to 2 pi QAB acting on this state is equal to the product of two local unitaries, one at A and the other at B. Now, suppose this psi has a uniform charge density, then the expectation value of this operator is just measuring the charge density, well, the total charge in this region, exponentiated, and that's equal to the two-point function of this local unitary. Okay, and basically, that says translation symmetry has to break in the ground state. There's a long-range correlation that kind of oscillate with distance, so that signals the translation symmetry breaking. Okay. All right, so this is a sort of a proof of Lipschitz-Mathis theorem. If you have a gap, you have translation symmetry breaking in the ground state with a Fresnel filling.
For the first line, you don't need to assume it's unique ground state. Right?
I don't have to assume it's unique ground state, yeah.
So there's can be fluctuations of QAB, right?
Yeah, there's fluctuations. Nothing that it's fixed. There are fluctuations, but here I'm just measuring the expectation value of QAB.
Yeah, I mean, this statement that it has to be equal to the right-hand side, is this something you have a proof for?
Yeah, I have I'm hiding some details, but you can prove this, right? Yeah, there's some additional steps going into this line, but roughly, you can prove this, right? Yes. Okay, now we can just apply this same argument in higher dimensions, basically doing the same trick. So for example, in two dimensions, let's look at Q in some region M, okay? And for exactly the same reason, e to the I theta Q, so now it's more convenient to just consider e to the I theta Q, the unitary transformation. When it applies to the ground state, the gap ground state, it's equivalent to applying some operator supported on the boundary of this region. Okay. Going through the same steps, one can show that the expectation value of this U is just measuring the number of charges inside the region, the average number of charges exponentiated. And if nu is not an integer, then this factor will change as you change the size of m, and suggests, this is not quite a proof, that no, this line is really a non-trivial Wilson line in the Lorentz theory, and we should interpret this equation as the braiding of some particle, which is a Weissung, which we call Weissung, that comes from 2-phi flux insertion around some background anion sitting inside this region. So this is just a different way of doing flux insertion. Instead of actually having a flux insertion, I'm just applying a defect operator in the region. Okay, so so far these are all known results of Lipschitz-Mathis theorem in, for example, 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1, and the constraints on the gap states, symmetric gap states. Now we are ready to apply this to a subsystem symmetry. So first, let me say a few words about why do we even want to think about subsystem symmetries. And the reason that subsystem symmetries are at least somewhat interesting is because it's closely related to, for me, it's related to fractal systems. And here's what I mean by subsystem symmetries. So let's say you have, so we're going to be consider three dimensions, and the subsystems are planes, two-dimensional planes. And you can imagine a system where each plane has a conserved charge of some kind, U1 or Z2. Okay? Then the charged particle, if we want to preserve these subsystem symmetries, have to only move in the planes. If you go from one plane to another, it breaks the subsystem symmetry. Okay? And you can have even a stack of these subsystem symmetries in three directions. And the particle that's charged in all three subsystem symmetries cannot go anywhere. It has to just stuck at its location if you don't want to break the subsystem symmetry. Okay? So that seems to give a way to kind of generate fractons. And to generate fractons, we just promote these global symmetries to gauge symmetries so that you cannot break it at low energy. Okay? So, and that has been demonstrated in lattice models. So if you start from this kind of a stack of planes and gauge the subsystem symmetries, in this case it's trivial because each of them is a 2D plane, you just have a Z2 symmetry on the plane, and the result is just a stack of Z2 toric code. Okay. However, once you have intersecting planes of subsystem symmetries and you gauge these symmetries, you have to be careful about what happens when they intersect. It turns out the result is a so-called XQ model. And it's no longer some decoupled stack of toric code. It's really a genuinely 3D state. And it features, for example, completely immobile particles called fractons and particles moving in one direction, the linons, et cetera. Okay, so hopefully that gives you a bit motivation to think about subsystem symmetries. And now I want to consider a subsystem symmetry with U1 symmetry, with U1. And the original hope for me was to find a setup where you can enforce some kind of fracton order in the ground state. Even though that hope didn't materialize, still find something interesting. So that's what I'm going to discuss in the rest, maybe 10 minutes. Okay, so what is a subsystem U1 symmetry, LSM? Well, it's the same setup. We just have lattice model with U1 symmetry and integer U1 charges on each side. Okay, and there's a fitting factor you fix to be a rational number. Okay. However, instead of just imposing the global U1, I also want to impose the subsystem U1s, let's say in all three directions. Okay. So there are a lot more conserved charges, for example, on each xy plane. The sum over these n should be conserved. On each xz plane, the same, and yz plane. Okay, we have three sets of planes. On each of them, you have conserved charge, U1 charge. Okay, just from the global U1, we know there's already a fitting anomaly, and you cannot have a symmetric short-range entangled state. And now, if we impose these symmetries, additional symmetries, we should expect that there are more constraints. So, what exactly are these constraints? Okay, so let's apply the same argument, the Lipschitz-Mattis, well, the flux insertion argument, or the formulated as the defect operator. So the most natural region to consider is now a cube. Let's say we apply the U1 symmetry inside this cube. And again, via the same sort of argument, if you have a gap ground state, e to the I theta of q in this cube should just be an operator supported on the boundary of this cube, right? And you can argue that it's going to measure the charge inside this region exponentiated. However, since we have conservation of subsystem charges, we can think of the total charge in this region as sum over charges in each of these planes. Okay. So what that means is that this operator actually has no support on the top and bottom surfaces because they already commute with Hamiltonian, since they are just sum over these operators. Okay. So these operators will create some excitations along these lines, but nothing on the along on these surfaces, but not on the top and bottom surfaces. Okay. However, we have three subsystem symmetries, so we can apply the same thing to all the other faces of this cube. So the conclusion is that this operator has no support. It's just identity on all the faces, except on these hinges. Okay. So this operator is really supported only on the hinge or on the cage. It's empty when you look at everywhere else, it's just supported on this cage. Just because we have these additional subsystem symmetries. But somehow, this operator is still able to measure the total charge inside this region. So there's nothing on the faces, it's just this cage. Okay. So it's somewhat strange that you have, if you want to interpret this statement in terms of excitations in topological order state, well, these lines should represent some particle. So somehow, this particle can braid along this cage, non-trivially, with some other stuff sitting inside.
So, for fractals, to what extent do we know that this fact that this partial symmetry action only hung on a boundary, to what extent do we know that it's still true?
Because that doesn't really rely on having fractals or not. It's just really about gap ground state, any gap ground state.
Even a sub-extensive degeneracy doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, yeah. It's about a single ground state in an infinite system. You can imagine this is the infinite system.
Right.
And we can even construct these operators explicitly by doing quadratic body evolution of currents. So for U1s, actually very explicit. Yes.
And does this U partial operator depend on the state?
Yes, so because the construction is using quadratic body evolution, it depends on the state. Yeah, for this particular ground state, it depends on the state, but no, we are only looking at the local part of the system. So it doesn't really matter whether we have topological degeneracy or not. Right. All right, so somehow we end up with this situation where somehow there's a particle that moving around in space knows about how many charges you have inside of the region. Now, the same thing actually happens in the fractal model. So without going into the details, let me show the picture. So in a fractal model, the XQ model actually, this line is a one-dimensional particle. In the sense that it can move only in one direction. So each of these lines is a one-dimensional particle, a line arm. And you have this braiding with a fractal sitting inside this cube. Okay? And the reason that you can have this braiding is because the fractal is created by a membrane operator, a rigid rectangle operator, and sitting at the corners. So this membrane can intersect with one edge of this cube. And that's where you get the braiding. Okay. So you may ask, OK, does it have to be fractals, or is this the only way to realize this kind of braiding? Okay. Now, first, let me actually discuss a little more about this XQ model at half fitting. So things of braiding kind of matches, so we expect that this model can be realized at half filling with subsystem symmetry. Okay. And we can even figure out all the kind of fractionalizations of symmetry. For example, a fracton has to have charge 1/2, and there's a background fracton sitting at the center of each cube, you can imagine that way. And we can construct this model using partons. So this is a physical model realizing X cube fracton order in this kind of system. Okay, now coming back to my original question is, you know, does it have to be a fractal model? Okay, it turns out that sadly it doesn't have to be, because we can reduce this theory by condensing certain dipoles of Linons. Okay? And that will reduce the theory to a toric code, a few copies of toric code. Okay. So what exactly is a constraint? You know, how much we can actually say given the kind of Lipschitz-Mattis constraint, the kind of constraint that we just derived. This is my last slide. So it turns out that one can argue the following. Okay. So remember, the feature that we extract from the Lipschitz-Mattis using defect operator of flux insertion is that there is this line operator supported on this, on the hinges of the cube, that measures the charge inside this cube, exponentiated, of course. Now, if we let's look at these two lines, each of them, we can think of it as a word line of some particle. And so I'll just say this is the word line of Wilson line of some particle A. And the top one is a Wilson line of the particle, but translated above by LZ steps. Okay, LZ is the size of this cube, the Z direction size of this cube. Here's a conclusion. So when LZ is not a multiple of Q, remember Q is the denominator of the fading factor. If LZ is not a denominator of, multiple of Q, then these two lines cannot be the same line. Okay? Otherwise, you can argue that this phase factor will be trivial. So somehow the line has to change as you move in order to actually know what's going on inside this cube. Otherwise, you'll not be able to measure the phase. Therefore, translation by any L that's not 0 mod Q must change the superselection sector of this particle. The particle has to change its type as it moves in space. And a conclusion, a result of that is that no local operator can actually hop A, this particle, by LZ steps if LZ is not 0 mod Q. So this is some sort of constraint on the mobility of particle, even though it's not actually fracton. Fracton would mean you take away this mod Q. Here, we're only able to argue it mod Q. But still, it represents some mobility constraint on the particles. So the ground state, or the topological order, or the gapped state, has to have this kind of constraints at low energy. All right, so I'll just put up summary. Basically, I want to show these two examples where the lattice effects somehow, talk to the continuum in some interesting ways. And I think this is still something that we haven't really fully understood. Okay. All right, thanks for your attention.
So for fracton topological order, the degeneracy you showed is the topological ground state degeneracy.
Right.
And I think to me that this type of degeneracy is different from the finite size Heisenberg model. So why do you think they should be understanding a similar way using those defects?
Well, I wouldn't say that we should understand the topological degeneracy of fractal model in the same way as the finite size spectrum of Heisenberg model. But I think what I probably wanted to say is that in some cases of topological order states, the ground state degeneracy changes with system size. Not for fractal model, even in an ordinary, conventional topological order. And that dependence can be understood in the same way.
And how about the Wendt-Plaquette model on the, it has?
Right. And that can be understood in the same way by having invertible defects.
I see.
By thinking about the different system sizes having different number of defects inserted. Right. But for fractal order, we don't know.
Okay.
At least I don't know how to think about it that way.
So in your last
slide. Hey, can I?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Okay, thanks. Well, thank you for the very interesting talk, but I have a question regarding your subsystem symmetry.
Right.
So the charge that you wrote down because I read some other paper that kind of looks at the same thing, where they're studying like LSM theorem associated to the system U1, but they have the charges they define are dipole charges. So they look like some Q times, it's essentially polarization.
Yeah.
Like Q times the dipole length, which looks a little bit different from what you have.
Yeah. So that's a different kind of, I wouldn't even call that subsystem. It's just dipole U1. And as far as I understand, dipole U1, you can, in this context, you can think of it as a global symmetry. It's not different from ordinary U1 in terms of LSM, roughly speaking. So, yeah.
Right, but here, in that paper specifically, they do have like a spatial foliation associated to these dipoles. Mm-hmm. Like the three directions of the dipoles are kind of, they have different, I guess, U1 charge.
Right.
In essence.
Right.
Yeah.
As I just said, I think for dipole U1, you know, the Lipschitz-Mathis or these kind of fitting constraints not really that different from the ordinary U1. For that purpose, you can think of a dipole as just basically an ordinary U1 symmetry, as far as I can tell. But subsystem is different, somewhat different.
Okay, so let's say, you know, we know that the LSM anomaly or the anomaly, the TOF anomaly, responsible for the LSM theorem is H2, right? Second group cohomology.
For the actual Lipschitz-Mathis, like spin 1/2, yes, H of 2, but U1,
yes,
is always a bit of a question of whether we should think of it as Tooth anomaly or not. Yeah, but I'm not using that.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, using the constraints. I'm just using the constraints on the lattice.
Right. So let's just think about spin for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have subsystem symmetry for a spin system,
mm-hmm,
then these LSM, the associated LSM theorem for these subsystem symmetries would be captured by H3. Would you agree? Or
I'm not sure whether it's captured by H3. I mean, even the ordinary LSM in three dimensions would be related to TRAPS 3, right? If I interpret your cohomology correctly, it's sitting at a site which is, you know, kind of a co-dimension 3 defect.
Right. Maybe I'm just I'm basing my question on this paper by Ryan and Dominic, which talks about the LSM anomaly.
Yeah.
And they say that the LSM anomaly is H2 of SO3 with coefficients in U1.
Oh, okay,
and
okay,
then,
that's what you mean. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about some other H2.
That's what I mean, sorry.
Yeah. Well, it just means that, no, the LSM, the actual LSM requires a projective representation of the global symmetry, internal symmetry at each site.
Right.
That is classified H2.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we can fit U1 into that framework.
Right, but what about subsystem symmetry? That seems to be a second order PT, which would be H3.
So you can certainly think about LSM where you actually have SO3 and put spin 1/2 on each site, but it starts to get a bit complicated once you look at subsystem non-abelian subsystem symmetries, because they don't commute. Or you can do Z2 cross Z2, then it will be the same, right? Then it will be H2, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, from that point of view, it's H2.
Okay.
Right. I think Yingchen.
So, yeah, in your last slide, if Q is not an integer, I guess that means the fitting factor is an irrational number.
Q is not an integer? Where did
I? You talk about fractal, the last slide, mobility constraint.
Oh, Q is an integer.
Yeah.
Q
is not an integer. That means the fitting factor is an irrational number.
I think irrational fitting means Q goes to infinity, right?
Yeah, irrational fitting means Q goes to infinity. But then, then you probably even don't have a gap state to begin with.
Yeah,
because
then, but
yeah.
Just curious that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. And probably in that system, you cannot have just an ordinary Fermi guess. Or okay, I'm not sure what exactly the constraints are in that kind of system. But no, from Dominic's work, we know even with a global U1 symmetry at arbitrary fitting, it puts very strong constraint on what low energy theory should be. Right? We only basically know two examples, Fermi liquid and superfluid. So imagine there are probably more constraints if you also have subsystem version of that.
So regarding the ability to restrict the symmetry actions on the boundary, what's the precise condition for that?
The precise condition is that you have a gapped Hamiltonian, local Hamiltonian, and it's gapped.
That's the necessary condition, but that's a sufficient condition, but is it necessary?
I would think that all you need is it certainly works when you have short-range entangled states.
Does it work for 3 plus 1 DU1 bit state?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know.
Is it enough if I only know that the local operators have
long range? I think you probably also have to impose some conditions about the entanglement structure, maybe. But I don't really know what's the kind of most general condition, right? All of these are assuming there's a gapped Hamiltonian. But the kind of states that we call gap states are ground states of short range entangled state or long range entangled state. They are gap ground states of Hamiltonian. So maybe these two spaces are actually the same. But I don't really know what's the most precise or most general condition. Yeah, these operators are constructed using the gap Hamiltonian explicitly. So. Yeah, it'd be good to know. But yeah, I don't know the answer.
All right, there's no more questions this time. Come on again.
Thanks.